Hey everybody, welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of December 9th, 2020. I am Charles Hain, writer at No Film School, and I am here with George Edelman.
Hello.
Editor-in-chief at No Film School. We are going to be talking about Chris Nolan's comments on Warner Brothers' decision to go direct streaming next year, which is a huge decision. Chris Nolan had some thoughts on it, and we have thoughts on Chris Nolan's thoughts. We're going to be talking about Mank. Yes, you've been hearing about it on Twitter for months. Mank. And it's a film about filmmaking from a great filmmaker, so we're going to talk about it. We have, in tech news, Apple continuing to offer support for the $6,000 monitor with the $1,000 stand. We've got all that and an Ask No Film School about how to get an agent this week on the No Film School podcast. All right, our top story this week, we need a little context on. So we talked about this in weeks previous. It's been big news. Warner Brothers, one of the big remaining studios, Warner Brothers decided that all of their 21 movies are going to be simultaneously released on streaming and for 1 month theatrical runs, and then might get longer theatrical runs depending upon how the money is doing. This is a change from this is day and date, right? As opposed to the previous world of a window where you'd release in the theater and then 9 months later it would show up on home video. This is a huge change for Warners to announce it for the whole slate, especially as there's been all this great vaccine news. So people were hoping that things might be different next year. But on the flip side, Warners is part of a big conglomerate and they have to make big decisions that pay attention to the bottom line, and they have to look at the smartest way to get their films to audiences. And I think if you're Warners and you're looking at how well Mulan did and how well some other things have done on streaming, you can see the appeal. The other traditional appeal to day and date has always been a simpler marketing program. Instead of trying to market the theatrical and then 6 months later market the home video release, it's one marketing campaign that is rolled out that ends with the tag, see it in theaters or on home today, as opposed to ending with in theaters today and then 6 months later having to do another marketing spend for on Blu-ray now. So Chris Nolan, who we all know, Chris Nolan, great filmmaker, makes wonderful big movies. Dunkirk is amazing. His new movie,
big fan of theaters too.
Huge fan of the theatrical experience. Huge, one of the big proponents that led to the IMAX for narrative purposes renaissance the last 15 years. Like big, one of the few people who can get big original tentpole movies made. Had a movie, came out theatrically last summer. Did not do well because of a pandemic. I think we can all agree that pandemic is the reason that
it's so weird. We've been kind of closely monitoring, and it's almost like you're summarizing 8 months of podcasts right now. Like, because we've been talking about this kind of slow drip development for so long, but going from what was happening to the theatrical model prior to the pandemic, then the pandemic and how hard it was hit, then how all the theater businesses are responding or suffering, and then pleas to maybe to the government to get involved, and then a major tentpole release like Tenet from Chris Nolan, who is Mr. See It in the Theaters, and it struggled, and then here we are now, and then slowly studios saying like, forget it, we're just going to go straight to streaming. And you could almost see this coming, like, because his partnership with Warner Brothers has been strong and successful for a long time. But as soon as Warner's is the one to say, we're going to put everything on HBO Max, it's just like you were waiting for the other shoe to drop with him.
So Nolan's comments are very aggressive. And look, I mean, so just to summarize, his comments are, film industry, Warner's in specific, you're being very short-sighted. The long-term view is let's keep theaters healthy and let's preserve the theatrical experience. Let's preserve first run in theaters and, you know, get through 21, get through the pain of this, soldier on, and preserve your long-term business. Don't let short-term thinking and short-term profits get in the way of long-term thinking. It is he says it very well. He says it eloquently. It is a very smart argument. Obviously, he's biased because he loves theater so much, but we all love theater so much, and I think that we all would like them to continue to exist, and I think it is right. What In order to do that, though, Warner Brothers would need to be a complete standalone entity that is able, you know, long-term thinking in business is often something you can only do when you have like tremendous cash reserves like Apple, or you have without the pressure of investors or corporate overlords or things like that. Like the business cycle, the stock market tends to really incentivize shorter term thinking. And what we're seeing right now is shorter term thinking. It is focusing on what are our numbers going to look like in 21? Is there a way we can save on the marketing expense? If we combine this marketing budget, can we get a bigger push out of our home release at the same time? Is there a way to make this all work now? And Nolan is arguing, well, let's worry about now because we have to survive, but also let's worry about the future, which is a hard thing for a business to do.
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point. Nolan's statements are articulate. He's a very smart man. He makes a great point. But there's a little key into where he sort of gets it wrong in regards to the nature of the industry. And I guess it's somewhat maybe arrogant for me to say he's wrong. But the quote he says, they're meant to be out there for the widest possible audiences, they're meaning the films. And now they're being used as a loss leader for the streaming service, the fledgling streaming service, without any consultation. Well, that makes sense in the context. What they're doing makes sense in the context of their job, because their job, it's not, I mean, to tease the next topic, it's not the days of Mank. The Warner Brothers is part of a massive conglomerate that has all kinds of income and costs and needs to write things off and ways to balance their books. And the theatrical movie part of it is just this tiny little, I almost want to say window dressing in like the massiveness of what they do. And there is still, I think Soderbergh came out with some comments, and we have a post on No Film School about his response, which is a little more, I hate to sound like I take a stand, but I tend to see Soderbergh as being a little more, I think he takes the longer view than Nolan on these topics. You know, he takes it all into perspective and where things are headed. And he sort of brings up that the bonanza of a major tentpole making billions of dollars or $1 billion is still going to be something a big company like Warner's will chase one day. But right now, it makes sense that that's being marginalized in the context of what's happening. Why would they consult the filmmaker? I know that sounds right. That sounds right. You know, like, yeah, they should consult the filmmaker, but they really shouldn't, because the filmmaker is not, if you're making movies for Warner Brothers, you're not a very important part of the big business plan. Like, I'm sorry to say, but that's just the fact of the matter. Like, one of the things that I believe that this pandemic has sort of done, or hopefully has done, is humble people a little bit. And I think that it should humble the film industry, which is used to seeing itself as super important. And that maybe a theatrical released movie is super important. And, you know, it's not that important when they're weighing the scales of their entire conglomerate during a global pandemic. It's just not.
But on the flip side, this pandemic has made the entertainment industry more important than ever. Like, what have we all done? What are our shared experiences this year? Like, what is it? Like, can you imagine how awful the 1918 pandemic, like, it must have driven so many people insane without Tiger King and The Crown and all of these things that we've done to have these communal shared experiences through this thing. So, like, it's just, it puts in a new perspective what media does and what we're looking for from it and how we consume it.
I think you're right. I mean, I would also just say that that points to maybe where there are places where it's extremely important, as storytelling and sharing of narrative and art always is, but it may not be in this traditional model that he thinks should be of the paramount importance to this company during this time. What the filmmakers or the stars of these projects, because he even says like filmmakers and stars who've given a lot to these projects, it just makes me laugh, because it's like, I just don't think that should be what Gal Gadot gives to Wonder Woman 1984 should be a major consideration. It's just like, it doesn't feel like it's that important in the grand scheme of things or in the small scheme of things. But I know to him, it's important. I mean, I think on the other side of the ledger, you have like Netflix, which is all about, and we're going to talk about Mank, but they're all about making the artists feel powerful and important to what they do. But they're also more built for this situation because they exist in streaming, you know? So this is their golden age for their business model, whereas the theatrical business model is just, this is going to be a hard time. But I completely agree with the statement that when this is over, the theatrical experience will be extremely important to people and they will be thrilled to go back to movie theaters and spend money doing that.
I mean, the thing that Chris Nolan's comments really hit on for me, and this is something that is beyond just the film industry. This is like civilization-wide. We are not very good as a society at thinking beyond the quarter. And it is incredibly difficult to plan for and suffer through small dips and look at what we want the world to be like in 10 years and execute on that. Like, we are a very short-term thinking. This is especially problematic in business, where it's all about, you know, sort of quarterly earnings and how that is affecting your stock price. But it's also a big problem for government that is all about the 2-year, 4-year election cycle. And like, this is hitting on that. This is yet another example of that, where Nolan is like, no, guys, in 2025, we're going to want a robust theatrical infrastructure. We will. We're not going to be locked inside forever, and going to the movies is so great. And I think everybody agrees with that. But Warner Brothers is like, yeah, but we can't wait that long, dog. And so they probably can't. The whole incentive structure, like, I don't know how to rebuild the stock market so that the stock market is focused on 5-year, 10-year cycles instead of quarterly cycles. I don't know how to do that. Like, I can't build a new stock market with, what's the thing from Futurama? I'm going to have my own card game with a whiskey and strippers or something. There's a meme. I don't, Bender, the dog. And it's like, I want my own stock market with 5-year windows or whatever. Like, maybe I'll try and build that. But that's the frustration here, is it's, you know, yet another example of the way we've built the structures of the world having consequences that are frustrating, which is like a very David Simon kind of story to tell. This day and date thing has been bubbling around for 20 years now. I remember Soderbergh doing it with Bubble in like 2000, whatever, 3 or 4. And it comes and then it sort of goes away. Like, maybe Warner Brothers in 22 will be like, oh no, we have these 3 movies and they're going to be exclusive to theatrical. It could happen, right? Like, 21 is going to be a weird year, but let's hope for 22.
I think you're right. I think it's hard, but another way in which I think that the pandemic, to make a larger point, has humbled us all or put things into perspective, is that it's really hard for us to grasp the scale of things. Like, this has been a global experience, and the numbers are massive, and the numbers are hard for us to understand. And I think that similarly, the time scale is hard for us to understand. Like, we all keep talking about, like, really, we all keep talking about how since March it's felt like, 100 years. Like this period has passed at a different rate. And I think that we will all be shocked at how quickly normal, once we get to whatever the new normal is, because it'll be different. But I think we'll be shocked at how far away this all feels. But also at the same time that all of that is true, there's a sense that like 2022, oh my God, that's so far away. It's really not. You know, like in the span of a life, in the span of history, it's not that far away. It's like the blink of an eye. I think that all that scale is hard for us to wrap our minds around. So as much as I think there's a good point to be made that it's like next year's movies and this year's movies and the Oscars this year are weird, it's like it's merely a footnote. Like it will be in 2-3 years, like there will be a new normal that's established, and this will be like this weird little bump that everybody's like, yeah, it kind of shifted the direction of how theatrical works. But, you know, to be honest, things were shifting anyway, as things are always shifting. But the business model was changing so much with theatrical and streaming, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that we will see like really big theatrical movies from Christopher Nolan again, and they will do well and they will be in theaters. I think that's a guarantee. It's just maybe not next year.
With that, on to Mank. So Mank, if you're not on Twitter, has been the subject of much Twitter conversation for the last couple of weeks. I don't know why, but everyone I follow on Twitter, including like Demi Adeju Yigbe and James Urbaniak, all love making jokes about the name Mank. Like, it's just been ongoing all summer, Mank jokes. There might be something I'm missing in Mank. Regardless, Mank, new film by David Fincher, relevant to this podcast because it is a film about the making of a film. Although it's not really about the making of a film. It's about the making of a screenplay. It's about the writing of Citizen Kane by Herman J. Mankiewicz, who wrote Citizen Kane, although there is a tremendous amount of controversy about how much was also written by Orson Welles. You know, a movie that is regularly listed as the best movie of all time. Of course, a lot of people are going to try and take credit for things. And so Mank just came out on Netflix. It's relevant in so many ways. First off, Mank is the first of Fincher's 4-year exclusive Netflix run. Fincher is obviously one of the filmmakers that has like dominated theatrical for 25 years between Social Network and Zodiac and obviously Fight Club, The Game, Alien 3, like big theatrical motion pictures, made a lot of scratch. He's doing an exclusive Netflix deal for 4 years. He's all in. He's like, no, streaming's where it's at. I just get to make the things I want to make. And Mank is an interesting example of that. First off, the script was written by his father, who has now passed away. Fincher tried to make the movie in the 90s, I think after The Game, and no one would let him make it in black and white. It is only getting made now in black and white, which is what this movie should be. Beautifully shot.
Although I have to say, I do kind of wish, I know that this probably wasn't an option, but I just wish it had been shot on film.
Well, no, it's entirely an option. People shoot on film all the time. But if you read interviews, it was a choice. Like they were like, no. We're going to be influenced by the period of the time, but we're not going to restrict ourselves purely to the limits of the time. And so like, you know, for instance, it's a 2.2 aspect ratio. Which isn't filmic. Filmic would be 1.85 or 2.39, but they went for 2.2 because they like it. And it's sort of like close to 3.9, but not quite.
I also kind of wish they'd done that. Like, I guess I wish they'd gone full. Who's the
good German?
Someone who does that. Yeah.
Good yes, German. Exactly. The Good German by Steven Soderbergh is the great example. First off,
yes.
Good German, underappreciated movie. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I did too.
Tobey Maguire gives a great performance.
For these technical reasons, really, but yeah.
Well, and the good German, Soderbergh, did that. He went full on. Yeah. He shot vintage. Like, he shot vintage everything. He only used lights that existed at the time. He only used the microphones that existed at the time. The good German is that. And I enjoy the good German. And the good German's super fun. And you guys should all go watch it. But the good German was Soderbergh's goodbye to analog before he became all digital all the time, shoot a feature or two on the iPhone, as he is today. So it's a different thing, The Good German. It's like a beautiful, I love The Good German. I'm going to go rewatch The Good German. It's really fun. But this is an interesting thing because there's this interesting thing where he's doing where Kane was at the cutting edge of technology. Like, people forget this. We think of the analog era as being like, all right, film was invented and in 1927 sound came along and there was no technological advancements until digital in 2008. And it's like, no, it was constantly evolving and constantly improving. And like, Citizen, you know, like, we forget that Greg Toland, in addition to being a great cinematographer, was also an inventor. He worked with Caltech to improve lens coatings, and it was only the second or third film he shot with the new, improved Caltech lens coatings that he had helped develop. He invented a stool for better adjusting lights with, like a little three-step ladder. He helped invent the color chart with Kodak. He worked in the development of film stocks. Like, all of these things came together. And carbon arcs had just been invented. He wasn't involved in that, but they were just invented for Technicolor. And he was one of the first people to say, hey, we could use these carbon arcs, which are super bright, which we need in Technicolor, because Technicolor was like 4 ISO, 6 ISO. Like, your modern digital camera doesn't even go down that low, how slow Technicolor was. They had to invent these big lights. And Greg Toland was like, what if I take these big lights intended for color and I use them for black and white, where the film speeds are faster? They had high-speed film, which was 50 ISO, and super high-speed film, which was 200 ISO, which is like mind-blowing at the time. Even the deep space we talk about from Kane was cutting-edge technology. You literally could not have shot Citizen Kane 5 years earlier. The lenses, the lights, the film stocks you needed didn't exist.
There were a lot of things about Kane that were innovative. The other thing that is worth mentioning is that color movies were being made at the same time as Citizen Kane. The big color movies that were changing the game had come out only a few years before. The first color movies were well before. So I think like people don't always understand in the context, like citizen, like there's just this kind of cloudy past of black and white that slowly transitions to color. But like Technicolor was alive and well and busting open blockbusters or whatever by 1941. By the time they shot this movie, it was a dominant, it was a big deal.
Yeah. But I think that that's the same thing that Mank is doing. Mank is like, we're going to use the latest technology. And we're going to have aesthetic goals. And those aesthetic goals are influenced by Kane, which is why it's black and white, which is why it feels the period. But we're going to use the latest technology to meet those aesthetic goals the same way they use the latest technology on Kane to meet those aesthetic goals.
Yeah, I could see that. I could also see that they say it's a choice when maybe it wasn't.
Fincher could shoot film for Netflix, I bet. I would be... Fincher is such a coup. I would not... I suspect. However, Netflix does have their requirement that you deliver in HDR, and that is doable in film. Film certainly, you know, wide latitude film stocks have 13, 14 stops of latitude, but HDR workflows are easier in digital.
Didn't they change the requirement for somebody, though? I think on one project, and I'm sure they would for him. I think you're probably right.
There's someone else that got away with shooting Alexa for their project back before there was a 4K Alexa. Netflix was 4K, but they still let one filmmaker do 2.5K because it was somebody famous. So I think also part of it is that black and white film stocks have frankly not kept up. I think the newest black and white film stock is from 1958, and that's Tri-X, the 58 version of Tri-X, not the 38 version of Tri-X. I don't think there's a newer black and white stock from Kodak than that. So if you want to shoot a movie in black and white, you either shoot it on color film and turn it black and white, or there are these amazing digital monochrome cameras, and they shot this in 8K monstrochrome. And, you know, that's there's benefits to that that I think are probably worth it. There's also a ton of digital effects in the movie. I mean, you can do digital effects on things shot on film, and I'm okay with all of that. I think that's all part of the interest to me in Fincher being Fincher. There's an expression in VFX called pixel fucking. Pixel fucking is that person in VFX who just will not quit in going to the limit to manipulate every single pixel to get it perfect. Fincher's a pixel fucker. Like that, you know, I would assume he would take that as a compliment. I don't know. We'll see if that gets me in a fight if I ever run into Fincher. But
also, speaking of Soderbergh, there was a quote recently, I think, where Soderbergh visited the set of Panic Room. And he said that Fincher was obsessing over how a certain light was in a certain corner of the frame, and they were taking forever just to reset it. And he being Soderbergh, I'm paraphrasing, by the way, so this quote, my version of the story may be not exactly how Soderbergh put it, but he says that he had some kind of panic attack thinking, oh my God, this guy is worrying about things that I can't imagine being obsessed over. So just more to your point of that's the kind of director Fincher is. We know that already.
Well, and let's be real, Soderbergh, not a pixel fucker. And you can love both of them. It is okay to love both of them. Yeah. I love both of them. I think they both make really interesting things. I regularly rewatch movies from both of them. Like, being a pixel fucker doesn't make you a good director. Not being a, like, it's irrelevant. It's a side issue. It's like whether or not you have a big couch.
More than one way to skin a cat. And it's more interesting to be your own person in your own way.
Yes, and I don't think Fincher can help it. I don't think Fincher's pretending to be a pixel fucker. I don't think Fincher's pretending. Also, at this point, he's been shooting digitally for his narrative work. I don't know about his commercials as well, but his narrative work since at least Zodiac in 2007, which shot on Viper, which was a ridiculous name for a camera from Grass Valley Group. And so, like, he's always done a lot of takes, but Zodiac, when he switched to shooting digital, is when he started going from, like, 70 takes to, like, 200 takes. Famously on Zodiac. First off, you can only get away with 200 takes when you're well-financed, because that could be a whole day shooting one shot. But also, that means that it's much harder to justify doing 200 takes on film. It just doesn't make sense the same way. So I imagine that played into his shooting practices probably make more sense on digital than they did on film in terms of his obsessive love of 200 takes. Yeah, I mean, Mank is an interesting film because it is also trying to crack at the creative process. Movies about writing are hard. You know, The Shining is one of the best movies about writing, and it's not about writing. It's about writer's block and psychosis, and there's murder involved. But like, movies about writing are hard. But you know,
Adaptation might be one of the best movies about writing. Right?
Adaptation is arguably the best movie about writing.
And it's very hard to make a movie about people talking mostly, and it's an older movie. Let's, like, on the surface, does this movie going to have broad appeal? It's about old Hollywood. It's about screenwriters. It's black and white. It's mostly people talking. You know, there's a lot of things that to people like me, it's a gem because he's a great filmmaker. But I love Citizen Kane. I love movie history. I love the study of what of the form. So there's so many ways. And I particularly love the Mankiewicz. Mankiewicz family is fascinating. And I actually wrote a little bit about it on No Film School once in a post about a Batman movie that didn't get made that was written by Mankiewicz's son. It's a whole long thing, but it would have starred Bill Murray, which I also think fascinating. But it was Tom Mankiewicz.
Wait a minute.
So there's Tom Mankiewicz.
Bill Murray as Batman?
It's a really crazy story. In the 80s, he had a script called The Batman. And his father was Joseph Mankiewicz, whose brother was Herman Mankiewicz. And Mank is about Herman. Joseph was his own really successful filmmaker, wrote and directed All About Eve, produced The Philadelphia Story, wrote and directed Cleopatra. So it's a family. And of course, there's Ben Mankiewicz, who is on Turner Classic Movies. But anyway, yes, Bill Murray was supposed to play Batman at one point. He was attached. And David Bowie was going to be the Joker. How crazy is that version of that movie? Anyway,
whew.
The Mankiewicz name is big in Hollywood lore. And Herman Mankiewicz had a tragic classic screenwriter in Hollywood in that era existence. But I think if you're familiar with the struggle, it's a great story. It's cathartic and familiar.
I used to teach a quarterly class where one of the things was we would watch Kane twice, once with sound and once without, and I would lecture over it without sound and a laser pointer and visual design. So like there was a time in my life where I was watching Kane probably 8 times a year and I never got sick of it. I no longer teach that class, or I haven't lately. So I haven't watched Kane more than maybe once every other year in the last 5 years or so. But you know, I've arguably seen Kane more than any other film in my life. I love Kane. Mank is less a film about the writing of a screenplay, and it's more a film about the birth of anger. You don't think of Kane as being an angry film, but if you think about it, Kane is a very angry movie about wealth, about the power wealth gives you in the world, about the way it tortures souls. You know, Mank isn't really about – you don't spend a lot of time watching him write. Thankfully, he had a typist, which is like super sexist, but so like you never actually have to sit there. I really enjoy the director who did the new Great Gatsby movie, Baz Luhrmann. Simply Ballroom's amazing. I really enjoy Baz Luhrmann. But like, there were scenes where we were watching Tobey Maguire type in the new Great Gatsby. The new Great Gatsby, which had great points, and like, oh my God, I was so happy to see a Great Gatsby by someone who looked like he knew how to party. Because the 1972 Great Gatsby, all the party scenes, I was like, have any of you ever been to a party? Because this doesn't look like a party, but like Baz Luhrmann has been to a party. But there's scenes where we're watching Tobey Maguire type, and I'm like, why am I sitting here watching Tobey Maguire type? I don't care that it's Tobey Maguire. So we never have to watch anyone type. There's no sitting watching someone type in Mank. I can promise you that. But he has an assistant do the typing for him, which, gender politics aside, is very helpful narratively.
Better for cinema.
It's not about even the writing process. It's about the process of growing in anger, the situations in the world that filled him with the anger to write Kane. And that I thought was a really interesting angle on a birth of a creative process movie.
You know, Jack Fincher, David's father, was a screenwriter. Obviously he wrote the screenplay. I think that it's taking the most famous movie in many ways, or certainly widely considered the best for a very long time. And mostly, as we've just spent time discussing, considered the best because of its visual storytelling and its innovation and its the way Orson Welles, this boy genius, you know, that's the story behind this movie, right? But I think that this movie, Mank, both in content, but in its placement in the world, is saying there's a screenwriter behind this. And that is just this sort of truism to Hollywood, which is like, who is this forgotten person, this forgotten suffering soul, who had to come up with this, who boiled this thing, who suffered with it, who was inspired to create it. And what is their story? Because that's the part we just don't celebrate. And in the case of Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, we often like overwrite it and just like say like, yeah, but isn't the genius? Like, I think people talk more about Greg Tolan and his genius, which I'm not trying to minimize at all. I think he's brilliant. When they talk about Citizen Kane, then they talk about Herman Mankiewicz. Like, just screenwriters get no love. It's just kind of the story of Hollywood. There's a lot of examples of great writers who came to Hollywood to, you know, write pictures, and it just chewed them up because William Faulkner. I mean, like, great. Speaking of Gatsby,
Fitzgerald.
Speaking of Gatsby,
there was even a like, joke at Fitzgerald's expense in Mank, which made me so happy. What's funny is that I don't know that screenwriters get destroyed by Hollywood. I mean,
I don't know that I would say they always get destroyed or what. I know plenty of writers who've done well out here and are happy people.
I think it's different than the 30s.
Yeah, it is. I've interviewed people on this podcast who write big movies and have great lives and seem like very well adjusted. Like, but I can just say, I think that it, and I think it's still fair to say that most of the movie going public does not think about the person who wrote the words. They think about the actor speaking them. Maybe they've started to think, maybe there's been a shift in the last 30, 40, 50 years to think about the directors. But by and large, television is the place where the writer gets to be king. And we talk about the writer more. Movies and film, and it's still true. There's a lot of people out there in every coffee shop in this town. Well, maybe not now because they're all closed as they should be. But in general, writing screenplays, it's hard to break in. It's hard to get recognized. It's hard to make more than one great one. I remember once, I'll never forget, I went to a screening of Chinatown, arguably one of the great screenplays ever written. And Mr. Town, Robert Town was there speaking about writing the script. And he did a Q&A. And there was essentially a question asked to him that was like so you wrote this amazing script. This is one of the great screenplays. This is not the question, but this was essential. This was the obvious subtext. Was, how come you never wrote another script that was quite as good? And his response was basically, the question was just like, it's so intricate and amazing and celebrated. And like, where in the rest of your work, it seems like you never, whatever the question was, that was the obvious subtext. And his response was, he was like, look, it was really, really hard to write that script. And you try to do that a lot, but you so rarely are rewarded for that extra time and effort in the industry that it becomes not worth it, which is a very honest, very true, painful admission. But it's like, hey, I can shoot out something and get paid and not have to suffer over it and not see it chopped up and destroyed by people or have stupid notes that I don't respect. Like, so why would I do this exactly again? And I think that it's just being a screenwriter. Like, you're creating a blueprint that everybody gets to move around, and, you know, it's tough, kids. Don't do it.
But I will also say, and this is, we'll wrap it up with Mank. In Mank, they do talk a little bit about the birth of the Writers Guild of America, the Screenwriters Guild. And that is one of the factors in life not being, you know, when we talk about all of those screenwriters from the 20s and 30s getting eaten alive by the machine, the Fitzgeralds, the Faulkners, the Manks, early deaths and alcoholism and all of that, it's all before the guild. And yeah. So like in, you know, when like screenwriting is still hard, and, you know, there are still jokes about how screenwriters are underappreciated, and there are still people who don't realize that the screenplays are written. They think the actors just show up to set and figure it out.
That's not a joke. I mean, I really do think that's a common belief.
Absolutely. Well, and it's also like, you know, the cliche I always make is like when I visit my parents and they're like channel surfing and my dad's like, ooh, the movie's starting. And my mom always calls in from the kitchen. Who's in it? She never says, who wrote it?
Of course. We all do that. I mean, on some level, though. Yeah, but yes, of course. Or like, did they shoot it in order? I mean, there's all kinds of things. Not to mock. It's just like, it's another industry. It's like, how do you make a car? I don't know how you make a car. I'm probably, if I was to, do they start with the bumper? Like, I don't know.
I think the guild is one of the things that is largely responsible for, and the growth of television where the writer has more power, largely responsible for it no longer being quite the cliche that it was in the 20s and 30s, that being a writer in Hollywood is just a machine that will suck you dry and destroy you, and you'll be dead at 55. Like, and that is a nice thing. So thank you, Writers Guild of America, East and West.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, moving on to tech news. So Apple, about a year and a half ago, came out with a display, the Pro Display XDR. If you don't remember it, you surely remember the fact that the display itself is $6,000. You could buy an $5,995. You could buy an optional different finish for the screen for another $1,000, getting you up to $6,995. And then on top of that, if you want a stand for the monitor, which does not come with its own stand, the stand was $1,000. Now, I'm an Apple user. I really like the new Apple silicone chips. I think the MacBook has finally come around. They fixed the keyboard issues that I hated and everybody hated, and they're fast now and they're great. I bought probably, when I used to own a post house, I had probably 40 Macs in my life. So I say this with like affection and dependence on Apple. $1,000 for a fucking computer stand is so stupid. It's ridiculous. And then I finally got to see it, and it's so dumb. And then I saw it in person, and what I was expecting was that the cables would be routed through it, because the cool thing about the stand is you can flip easily from vertical to horizontal mode, which is nice, right? A lot of people like their big, long monitors vertical, so you can easily flip it for how you need to use it. Great. And it auto-detects or whatever. But I was thinking, since you've got to flip it around, the power and the signal cables – must be routed through the stand, right? So that you don't have to worry about wrangling cables when you flip from horizontal to vertical. No, there's no cable routing. That $1,000 doesn't even get you cable routing. That $1,000, which could also buy you a MacBook Air, a brand new MacBook Air you could get for that $1,000, which has like a processor and graphics and ports and a battery and a screen. That $1,000 stand doesn't even route cables. It's so ridiculous. Okay, moving on from that. What most people I know who've purchased this monitor have done is they've mounted it using like a Visa mount on some sort of arm. There are other stands available. You don't have to buy the $1,000 stand. But what's interesting about the monitor for me is that Apple is really marketing heavily its color accuracy. What do you mean by color accuracy? Well, if you've ever had that frustrating thing happen where like you work forever on your movie and it looks perfect on your computer monitor in Premiere, and then you do an export and you upload it to YouTube and it looks a little different, but you're not that worried. And then you send it to your parents' house or you send it to your friend and you open it on their PC and it looks radically different. Like everything, you know, you had an orange t-shirt in your Premiere and it looks red on the other monitor. That's color accuracy. Color accuracy is about, do monitors reproduce the colors properly? And for the first time ever for a computer monitor, Apple is really marketing this monitor as being highly color accurate, comparable to $30,000 Sony BVM color grading monitors, fully capable of HDR color reproduction. And that's interesting to me. Now, the trick is that software is part of the situation with color accuracy. Like, If you haven't noticed, try it sometime. Video will look different in QuickTime Player than it will look in Premiere, than it will look in Resolve, than it will look in Final Cut Pro, because every piece of software has its own like video engine. So that's a terror here. Like, I'm really afraid I'm going to like send a cut to client and they're going to watch it and be like, it doesn't look right. And I'm going to be like, oh no, it's just your monitor. And they're going to be like, I paid $6,000 for the monitor. It must be right. And I'll be like, what did you watch it in? And they'll be like, Internet Explorer. And I'll be like, well, first off, how did you install Internet Explorer on your Mac? And secondly,
this conversation sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, it's such a nightmare. It's such a nightmare. And it's the life we all live in all the time. But Apple's continuing to push this as a color calibration display, which I think is a good thing. And if they can solve the software issue, we're in real cooking. And I will say this, of everything I've seen, Resolve appears to be the most accurate. Like bringing the media into Resolve, clicking Command F to full screen it is really close to correct, which is impressive. Because even 5 years ago, even in Resolve, you couldn't do that. But nowadays, in Resolve, in full screen, you can compare it to like an externally fed broadcast monitor, and it's shockingly close. What's interesting to me is about Apple continuing to push it is they just released, this is the news part, calibration software, which is free, which, I mean, it better be, $6,000 monitor, calibration software for your Pro Display XDR. So that means if you have a Pro Display XDR, monitors will drift. New monitors don't drift much. Like, I used to have a plasma monitor I had to calibrate once a month. New monitors, you check them every 6 months or a year, and they've usually drifted very little. I don't know how often this one drifts. I haven't calibrated one. But you want to check them on the regular just to make sure they're still accurate. They should be accurate when you leave the factory. You want to check them. And usually the software is like $1,500. Like, if you want to use an independent software like Lightspace or Calman, those are like $1,500, $2,000 software. So it's nice that they've released a free app. However, the free app only supports a couple of probes. You need a probe to – you put a probe on the monitor and the calibration software shows various colors and the probe reads them to see if they're correct. The most common probe in motion picture post is the Klein K10A, which is $7,000. I mean, it's not cheap, but it's cheaper than every single probe that's supported. The cheapest probe that's supported by the Apple software is $15,000.
Hmm.
So I actually emailed Apple. I was like, come on, please support the K10. Come on. Like, at least support the probe that most post houses own, that like is at least around, that like DITs own. A $15,000 probe is so expensive.
Yeah.
It's so expensive. It's more than I think I've ever spent on a car.
It's definitely forcing a certain level, a big level or multiple levels of people into making other choices, right?
But it's not into making other choices because, like, frankly, most people didn't buy Apple monitors anyway. Like, I can't tell you the number, I've been in so many suites that are like, a Mac Pro Tower with two Dell monitors. I mean, for like 6 years, they weren't even making cinema displays at all. So, in 2008, 2009, pretty much everybody had the cinema displays because they were very nice and they were affordable. I had the jelly cinema displays and then I had the silver cinema displays. So like it was a thing for a while where they were around. But then, you know, in the mid 2000s, they stopped making them. They hadn't come out with a replacement. So everybody had Dells or LGs or a few other companies sort of moved in on that space. Izo makes some really nice monitors that people loved. And so it's like, it's just one of those things where I'm like, this is clearly targeted at a very specific niche in the market. A huge post house will have it's a CR300 is the $15,000 probe. A big post house will have a CR300. Sure. Flanders Scientific sells them. You can buy them. They're around. So yeah, this is currently, the Pro Display XDR is currently targeted at the high end of the market. My fear is that a big commercial client who knows nothing about color will buy one and I'll have to deal with explaining to them why it's still not right if they're watching it in YouTube, in Explorer. It seems like Apple is, I'm glad they released the app free. I think that's cool. I wish they supported more probes that were more affordable.
It's funny. It's hard to get you to get critical of Apple. I mean, well, no, it's not. To be fair, you've done it before, but you tend to find the positive.
I mean, I tend to find the positive in everything.
This is true. Just coming off of our screenwriters in Hollywood conversation, I realize you do have a good ability to do that.
I mean, I was looking back. Somebody asked me about negative reviews I've written. And I was like, oh, other than the 2016 MacBook Pro, which I hated and wrote a long, scathing review of, which is still the meanest thing I think I've ever written. I hated the 2016 MacBook Pro. It was awful. I hated it so much. Other than that, I tend to focus on the positive. Every once in a while, something will thoroughly – I mean, we also live in bountiful times, man. I mean, like –
for tech. Maybe for tech. Everything.
Yeah. No, but for movies, like you can sit around and get almost every wonderful movie you ever wanted to watch on the internet and just watch it at home. Like even when I was in undergrad, we had to go to the library to check out Laserdiscs to watch some of these amazing movies. Like I remember sitting in cubicles watching Godfather 2 on Laserdisc on like a 23-inch screen because that was how I got to watch it. So the fact that I can now sit at home and watch the Godfather 2 on a 55-inch calibrated monitor is such like a luxury.
I would agree. I think that in some ways you could make the case that there are two sides. There is the positive side, which is the availability, but then such a gluttony of availability can become paralyzing and I think may limit people's exposures in another weird way, but it's all what you make of it, right?
Yeah, well, and I have an incredible amount of negativity about, like, labor practices in the film industry and how fucked it is. I think we are all...
That is true.
You know, yeah. There are things that get me really angry. I don't get really angry about, like, people get so angry about, like, Apple's taking away this port or whatever. And I'm like, I don't miss my headphone port on my phone, whatever. I don't care about that. But, like, the fact that the default on film sets and in post is that you work 12-hour days and 6-day weeks makes me fucking furious.
Yeah.
And I think I just reserve my negativity for that and, like, the total failure of the U.S. government to provide any more pandemic relief since April, which is, like, you know, what actually gets my blood. Like, it's so much easier for me to get worked up about that, that, like, I don't have energy left to be angry about.
About a movie? Yeah, I would agree.
A movie or tech stuff. Like,
or a tool.
You know.
Or a tool that doesn't work, it's like, right.
There's a part of me that's annoyed they don't support the Klein K10, but then also it's a free app. So if they don't think the Klein K10 is good enough, I get it. I think they should support the Klein K10. I hope they eventually do, but I get it. And frankly, it's never going to affect me because I don't own one of the Pro Display XDRs. It's not in my budget. Moving on to our Ask No Film School. I picked this one because it is screenwriting relevant. Our Ask No Film School this week is from James Lynch. This one comes up a lot, but I don't know that we've ever directly answered it before. Question: I have completed a screenplay. I'm looking to get a meeting with a Big Six agent to discuss my work and to see if they'd represent me. I got email responses from the gatekeepers of the agency saying that they don't review unsolicited work unless it's presented by an established entertainment representative. What does an established entertainment representative mean? Isn't that an agent? Isn't that what I'm trying to get? It feels like a catch-22.
It is all such a catch-22.
How do I get an established entertainment representative if no one is willing or even unable to meet with me due to the company policy not to meet with me without a representative? Thanks. And then he ends, never be satisfied! Exclamation point, which I think is a good way to end a question. It's a bold way to end a question.
That is sign-off? That's a great sign-off.
So just to go big picture with it, not everything is economics. Love is not economics. This is a supply-demand problem. So in every other industry in the world, like, it's equal, like, every industry would act like this if there was so much supply, right? Like, the joke I always make is, if there was so as many people trying to be accountants as there are trying to be filmmakers, applying for a job in accounting would feel the exact same way. But the thing is supply and demand are somewhat closer to each other. They're almost at equilibrium in a lot of those other jobs. So there's avenues. There's, like, job boards you can go on, monster.com, Indeed, and they advertise, and you can submit, and there's, like, systems in place for doing that. There is literally so much supply of filmmakers. There are so many people who have that dream and want to tell that story. I mean, there was a news segment, and this was in the 90s, before laptops, before Final Draft was common. This was in the 90s. They did a news segment in LA, and they just walked up to everybody who came out of a grocery store, and they said, tell me about your screenplay. And every single person said, oh my God, how did you know I was working on a screenplay? And then started their pitch. Every single person, like, all day long. Like, that's LA, and yeah. That was LA 25 years ago. I mean, there's a shame in it. That doesn't mean your dream is invalid. We all dream, you know, like, never be satisfied, keep pursuing it. But it changes the market economics. So it means that it's not easy, right? Like, it is not always an easy thing to do to find your way into a meeting with a Hollywood agent. So there are a variety of avenues you could pursue to do it, depending upon your age. If you're young enough, the best thing to do is to try and get a job as an assistant at a management company or an agent. When the agents are saying you need an established representative, they're saying you need a manager. Managers will often take their clients to agents. Managers will say things like, I think you need new agents, and they'll take you out to try and shop you for a new agent and whatnot. So you need a manager of some sort. And one of the best ways to get one of the ways I know many people ended up with their first representation was they got a job as an assistant, and then they were on that desk listening to phone calls for 2 or 3 years and learning everything about the industry from those phone calls. Meanwhile, they're writing in the mornings. The agents would read their stuff, give them feedback, grow them to eventually be good enough to represent, then maybe represent them in the beginning. And eventually, you might even be represented and still be the assistant until they've sold something and you're making enough money to just be independent. So I know a lot of people who got representation like that. The other avenue is awards. There are
contests.
Contests. The Blacklist is your best bet in 2020 by far. The Blacklist is a website that is designed to help writers find producers and buyers. You submit your script. It gets read by professional readers and rated and put up there, and other people can read it. And it's a great program, and we really recommend the Blacklist. I think it's really an amazing thing. And you can try and win the Nichols or one of the other. There's like 5 or 10 screenwriting contests that are probably worth the entrance fee. I know we have lists on No Film School if you Google it. Jason Hellerman thinks there's only 2, and he's a working screenwriter, so I'm going to defer to him. He was on the podcast, and he said the only 2 that mattered were the Nichols and I forget the other one.
Here's the problem. Like, having known countless people who've been repped, having been repped myself at one of these, I can tell you that there's a lot of weird ways that it happens that aren't by design. Meaning, for me, it happened because I made a short. Like, I produced a short and I was co-writing something with the guy I worked on the short with. And people liked the short at a festival. And the people who liked the short at the festival were managers. And they said, you don't have an agent? And they sent us before, you know, and pretty quickly, like, things snowball. There's weird ways things happen. And a lot of people I know who were repped by very big agents just happened to be working on random shorts with other people who were repped by big agents. And they were like, hey, I'm going to work with you on X project. Oh, you got to have an agent. Or I want to bring such and such guy onto my writing staff. Okay, well, he's not repped by anyone. Okay, well, he'll be part of my agent's pool or whatever. And then there's this whole thing of hip pocketing, which is like, sometimes you'll be repped, but not really. Like, repped until you sell something. So there's all kinds of ways this happens. But what they are asking, like Charles said, is they're asking if you have a manager. And it just sounds like, wait, I got to get this guy now. It's kind of like an episode of The Mandalorian where it's like he's searching for one thing. Wait, no, but you got to go get this thing first. And then it's just this endless cycle. We have 3 posts on nofilmschool.com that I would cite that are useful in this process of discovery. One is called How to Get an Agent for Writers, Directors, or Actors. It comes with a checklist. One is called What's the Difference Between a Manager and an Agent? And one is called The Complete Guide to Representations for Writers and Directors. And there's a lot of information about how it works and who's who and what the process looks like and all of those. And they're written by people and edited by people who know what this whole landscape looks like. I would just say again, though, that it's kind of like the, I think I've said this before, there's an if you build it, they will come quality to this town. And it's sort of like if you make stuff, this is why the contest route sort of works. Like, if you make stuff and people see it or like it, then there's going to be something that happens. Even if they're not like my story where it was a manager who saw it and then kicked you over to an agent, et cetera. It might just be that another collaborator likes it. And then you work with that collaborator. And then that collaborator gets you somewhere where you're on a project where you need an agent. It's just, you got to go into that coal mine every day and keep going, and things happen. And if you stop, and it's very hard right now because there's a pandemic, so it's hard to show up and suit up for anything. But if you do it, it just kind of like something happens. Like, your work will get better, but also you'll start to work with other people whose work is better, who will start to be on projects, and things just fall into place. And I will reiterate something I never said before I started doing all these interviews at No Film School, but I've learned through that. Everybody always says at some point in their story of how they got started, they always have this, I was very lucky. You'll hear that so much. And I think it's because it's like circumstances fall together. Like, you keep showing up, you keep doing the work or exhibiting your work, something will happen that feels lucky. Like, the right person will see it, and then that person will get it to the next right person. And then maybe that'll be a dead end, but then there'll be another thing. Like, I just, that's my, like, the problem is, like, it's kind of like you were knocking at the biggest door by going right to CAA and saying, here's my script, can I have an agent? It's sort of weird, but it's like, you have to knock at the first smallest door, which is, God, I don't even know what it is. It's write the script, or it's submit it to a competition, or it's make a short, or it's send it to managers. But I even feel like, I don't know, Charles, what you think, but I even think sending it cold to managers doesn't always move the needle. There's so much
at all. Like, right? Cold mailing is, Cold emailing is not the move in the entertainment industry. But there is an exception, which is, I know, like, going back to what George said of, like, it's always some weird, crazy angle thing. Like, you know, before they did movies, the Wachowski sibs did comic books. Before David Simon wrote television, he wrote normal. I mean, he wrote newspapers first, and then he turned his newspapering into books. And then he used his book agent to get himself into screenwriting. And actually has all sorts of thoughts about that. And weirdly, the traditional publishing industry will still take a query letter and a sample chapter. So if you think your screenplay idea is an amazing story and you are passionate as a writer, turn it into a query letter and a sample chapter and send it to publishers.
Because that's such a great piece of actionable advice. Thank you for that.
Yeah. They still read them. There's, I mean, obviously not the publisher, the agent's assistant will read, but like part of the publishing industry is still the query letter sample chapter thing. They will get read. You know, I've published three books. A book that I wrote that didn't get published, still like the sample chapter query letter I sent out for that, like 8 years ago, it was so satisfying because after years of like screenplays not getting read or having a script and, you know, it was just so great to be like, oh, I just send this out to people. And like, it was very clear by the responses that like many people, like it was read. I was like, oh, you guys read it. It's not a fit. I get it. Makes sense. Fine. But like, it was clearly there is a system in place for this. Someone in your office does read these things. The response letters were like engaged.
You bring up a good example with also the comic book or graphic novel thing. People I know personally, but Dan Harmon, who's now a successful TV writer, wrote the script or the dialogue for his friend's comic book. That was like his first thing, and they were doing comic book shows and get it, and that sort of got them snaking into the world of like, do you need to be repped by writers? Like snowballs. I know other people who ended up like EPing shows who it started in comedy groups in LA, like Groundlings type stuff. Like, so it can come many different ways. I think the active thing you can do is you can do that. You can submit to publishers a chapter and a query letter. You can also just try to connect with people and create stuff and put it out there and use those avenues to get attention. Like if you create something that gets some attention, then people will want to work with you or want to represent you. But also the assistant route is a very, like, I mean, you become a writer's assistant, you will get, which is a hard job to get, by the way. But I've had friends who I was producing on a show and I got a friend a job as an assistant on that show. He was like, he came back to LA. He was like, I want to write. And I said, well, I'm like a production manager on this little like pilot for Comedy Central. And I was like, but they're looking for a writer's assistant. So give me your resume. I'll put it at the top of the stack. I did. He got the job pretty quickly. He was asked to be someone else's writer's assistant for a showrunner pretty quickly. He was writing an episode pretty quickly. He started writing screenplays for somebody else. Like getting that first thing can be the key, but like, how do you get that writer's assistant gig? You know, there's a lot of ways is my point. But probably going right up to CAA is not, or right up to a manager is not one of them. I did an interview with the guys who made the film Peanut Butter Falcon, and their story was all about doing that. They were like, they would just like bang at the door of a CAA over and over again, no matter what, until somebody answered. Like they'd sleep. This is a metaphor, but they would literally like, they'd sleep outside the doorway of the production office and wait till someone would come in and bother them until, that doesn't always work, by the way. But like sometimes the weird, desperate things like work out. They lied about having a star attached to something to get a call that led to another thing that like, so it's kind of it's like a sandbox, like, you have to find your way. You have to play your hand the best you can, but it does involve sometimes strange strategies.
All right. That was a very thorough answer.
I love the question. I feel like
I love the question too. I love never surrender.
Yeah.
Everything about that ruled. All right. So that has been the Indie Film Weekly for No Film School. I am Charles Hain. You can find me on the internet at charleshain.com or Twitter and Instagram at Charles Hain. And there's nothing to add us about this week on Twitter, but you can add us if you feel like it.
And I'm George Edelman. And thank you all so much for listening. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook. Send your questions like that one. We love that question to ask@nofilmschool.com. And be sure to check out everything happening on nofilmschool.com. Next week is Sound Week. There's going to be a lot of cool content, really exciting interviews on the podcast with some sound designers of major movies you've definitely seen and whose sounds you definitely remember. So check that out.